Will you pray with me, please? Gracious God, we ask that you would always be in our presence, a moving spirit, helping us to hear what is your word and your hope for the world in all that we do and say. Amen. One of the great human misconceptions is that our best values will never lead us astray. Now, I take this as pretty bad news. Most of us believe, I think, that justice and fairness and responsibility, for example, are some of the most important things in life. Our churches and denominations hold them in high regard. We fight and advocate for them. Religious teaching would suggest that justice, fairness, and responsibility are ingredients in any recipe for thy kingdom come on earth as it is in heaven. Is that really a mistake? Maybe. Maybe not. It's complicated. More complicated than we may think. Teacher, please tell my brother to divide our father's estate with me. Fair enough. The man comes to ask Jesus to settle a family dispute, and the only thing the man asks for is fairness, justice. It's the kind of thing that would have been brought regularly before the rabbis or teachers all the time. In every synagogue, there was a seat called the seat of Moses. You can put up this first slide and leave it there if you would. The teacher would sit on the seat and teach or render judgments. This particular one is found in the ancient synagogue in Chorazin, just a few miles from the Sea of Galilee. Teacher, please tell my brother to divide our father's estate with me. Pretty reasonable request. And yet Jesus answers in a way that we are unprepared for. Friend, who made me a judge over you to decide such things as that? Is Jesus shirking his duty today? Is he having a bad day? Why would Jesus respond this way to a man who is simply asking him to hand out justice, to be a judge, to do his job sitting there on the seat of Moses? Or is Jesus really telling the man that fairness and justice don't matter? Now, we've seen this side of Jesus before. The prodigal son. The older son wants fairness, and the parable makes him out to be the bad guy, while his delinquent brother gets the fatted calf. Mary and Martha. Martha just wants some help around the house. Mary sits at Jesus' feet, not helping, and Jesus says that the diligent Martha is the one who's got it all wrong. Martha, really? We really have but two choices here. We can dismiss these stories. We can say that they are wrong, that Jesus didn't really mean what he says. We can just ignore them because they're so obviously offensive to our sensibilities. Or we can wonder if Jesus has something important to teach us and grapple with these stories that seem so counterintuitive. Now, I want to think to fall into the latter camp. I think this Jesus is a pretty smart guy. And I think that when he tells a story that pushes against the things that we hold most dear, it should call us to pay special attention and not just ignore them. We like to believe that God agrees with us about the things that we hold most dear. But it just may be that from time to time, Jesus wants to teach us about some important flaws in our most sacred cows. Teacher, please tell my brother to divide our father's estate with me. Now, Jesus didn't like the request. He as much as berates the man. And then instead of talking about fairness, he addresses the issue of possessions. Life is not measured by how much you own, he says. And then he tells a story sometimes called the rich fool. You can put that up and then you can just leave it there. It's a pretty straightforward story. A man becomes a successful farmer. He tears down smaller barns and builds even bigger ones. He stores and expands his wealth. His goal is to have it made in the shade. Now, take it easy. Eat, drink, and be merry, he says. But lo, he finds out that he is going to die tonight and that he can't take it with him. That's an important reminder. We can't take it with us. One man decided to try. He gave instructions that all of his cash should be stuffed in his coffin with him. And just before they closed the casket, his lawyer stepped forward, slipped a piece of paper in the dead man's vest pocket, and stuffed all the cash in his briefcase. Asked the lawyer what in the heck he thought he was doing, and he said, "I just wrote him a check so he won't have to carry all that cash around." Well, I think we can be confident that cash, checks, or credit cards won't be of much help after we die. You can't take it with you. But that's hardly Jesus' most important point, though it's a good reminder. Jesus was concerned about what the rich fool thought about all of his possessions and what they would buy him even in this life, too. Would he, in fact, eat, drink, and be merry? Andrew Carnegie, who knew a thing or two about wealth and possessions, once said, "Millionaires rarely smile." Wealth and a lot of other things, too. Fame, good looks, status, come up empty. Come up empty on delivering fulfillment in life. So it's not just that you can't take it with you. Barns full of money won't buy you what you think they will, even here. The reasons are manifold. Some people are busy accumulating things and they don't even bother to try to enjoy them. They never have enough, so they just keep accumulating. Others find themselves completely overwhelmed by the attention it takes to protect and maintain all of those things that they have and that they have accumulated. You know, Stone Age people had a lot of things pretty rough, but they didn't have a lot of stuff to worry about. And researchers tell us that Stone Age people worked about 3 hours a day and the rest was leisure. Stuff doesn't buy us time or freedom. Even more disappointing, those who actually try to enjoy their wealth often find that the enjoyment is hollow and unfulfilling. It simply doesn't deliver. Money can't buy you love, as the Beatles song goes. It can't buy you a lot of other things either. So Jesus tells the story of the rich fool to pose the question, just what does all of that accumulated wealth get you anyway? Not much, it turns out. Not much. Now these are important life lessons. You can't take it with you, and all the stuff in the world won't lead to contentment or fulfillment. And all of us can benefit from taking those lessons to heart. But Jesus doesn't really stop there. You know, Paul once said that the people needed to graduate from spiritual milk to spiritual solid food. There was nothing wrong with the easy, digestible spiritual milk, but spiritual solid food was even more nourishing, even if a little harder to eat. And so far, what we've looked at has been milk. But that's only just the beginning. Teacher, please tell my brother to divide our father's estate with me. For Jesus, the man's whole problem stemmed from his beginning point, and that was himself. Tell my brother to divide our father's estate. Divide it with me. The man's appeal for fairness all begins in self-interest. I want what's fairly mine. I want. The starting point, rather than the idea of fairness itself, may be what gets him in trouble. I want. Let me come at this another way. In John 8:32, Jesus famously says that the truth will set you free. In the most basic sense, that might mean that telling the truth frees us from the burden of living within a web of lies. And that's surely true. In a spiritual sense, it might mean that seeing God truly gives us peace, maybe even salvation. The truth will set us free might mean the truth we get, that from the truth we get something. Dietrich Bonhoeffer understood the problem with this way of thinking about truth better than anyone I have encountered. The way of thinking about truth and freedom. He understood that the freedom that Jesus was talking about was not all about what it would get for us. The freedom that the truth sets you free for is, in his words, freedom from yourself, not freedom for yourself. He says, becoming free does not mean becoming great in this world, free in relation to our brother, free in relation to God, but it means becoming free from oneself, from the lie that I am the only person out there. As you may recall, this was humankind's mortal sin in the garden, that they would become like God, to know and do anything they wanted. The serpent seduced Adam and Eve to believe that freedom was all about them. In the Germany of Bonhoeffer's early 30s, he understood only too well that language of God, nation, and freedom can be marshaled to justify becoming great in this world. And there it was disastrously self-seeking. But the snake in the garden allowed it to employ rhetoric to make it sound good and righteous and just. Teacher, please tell my brother to divide our father's estate with me. It was about him. It was about becoming great. So here's the hinge. The solid food. It has everything to do with our starting point. If the starting point is our own self-seeking, if we are at the center of things and the most important thing and the very beginning of everything, then fairness and every other beautiful value that we can think of too easily becomes twisted. It becomes squarely aimed at us. It is for us, first and foremost. Once we make that move, as much as we may appeal to moral language, we will seek to be free for ourselves, not from ourselves. We short-circuit attention to and concern for anything outside, God, other people, for example. Very quickly, that allows us, as it did in Germany, as I can point to places all over this country right today, to hurt other people using high-sounding moral language to justify it. Since Adam and Eve, it is one of the main things that make the world go round. And Jesus understood that the vulnerability applied not just to the extreme cases, but infected even very innocent-looking situations. Jesus worried about the man who wanted to settle the family estate. The man thought that his being treated fairly would make his life right, which of course it wouldn't. What Jesus understood was that not only would it not make the man's life right and happy and satisfied and all those things, but the man's insistence on self-serving fairness might very well lead him to harm himself and others along the way. We have all seen the bitterness that arises in families, even when everyone just wants to be treated fairly. Now, I want to come back to this in just a minute. I don't want to throw fairness entirely under the bus. But I want to think about where Jesus was trying to point the young man who came to him. He wanted to ask him, "What do you think will really set you free? What do you think will really set you free? Is it your share of the family silver? Is it not getting taken to the cleaners by your brother? Are those the fundamental things that will define your freedom? Isn't there a fundamental flaw in that thinking," Jesus says? "Does not your freedom come from something else, from a radical trust in something outside yourself, something larger than yourself?" Now, God can be such an abstract word, but what Jesus was talking about here is trust in something other than ourselves. Trust so deep and so strong and so solid that neither life nor death nor angels nor principalities nor things present nor things to come nor powers nor height nor depth nor anything else in all creation will be able to separate us from it. This is the trust that sets us free. This is the truth that sets us free. No matter what else happens in our lives, this trust trumps it. It sets us free to love others because we have to be less protective of ourselves. It sets us free from the world's messages about what's most important or what will make us so happy or what will fulfill us or what we need to be recognized. It sets us free to rest securely in the mercy of God. Now, this shift in orientation changes everything in both subtle and profound ways. The man could still come with a problem of settling the estate to the rabbi. But come in the light of that trust, the stakes would be different. His affect would be different. Standing on the solid foundation of trust in something beyond himself and his present situation, the man could appeal for fairness. But rather than being about what he deserves or what would make his life absolutely wonderful, it might be about a desire to respect his father and his father's wishes. Or it might even be about love for his brother, whose greed he knows will be corrosive. It might even be about the idea that fairness is a good principle to follow. But it would no longer be about the presumption that getting his due share of the estate was essential to his well-being. And that's really important because he can't take it with him, true enough. Even while he's here, it won't be the source of his well-being. And most important, to the degree that he thinks it will be the source of his well-being is the degree to which he will cut himself off from the true source in which he can truly put his trust. This is the truth that sets you free. Amen.